about by food and clothes for all the world, for all over the world. The same amount buys food and clothes for all the world, for all over the world.
And now, specially actually created for the conference and the meetings that are going on.
If Davos doesn't want it, we shall not be moved. If the Swiss don't want it, we shall not be moved. New York workers need healthcare and schools and jobs. We shall not be moved. Government and big business, we shall not be moved. Government and big business, we shall not be moved. Free world trade gives us worldwide exploitation. We shall not be moved. They talk globalization, we shall not be moved. Controlling little nations, we shall not be moved. This world trade moves are driving down our wages. We shall not be moved. NAFTA brings pollution. We shall not be moved. We've got a solution. We shall not be moved. Across all borders, we must stand united. We shall not be moved. Across all borders, we must stand united. We shall not be
This is the debut performance of the Raging Grannies. I don't think this is working. I'm going to turn on the video. We're going to move very rapidly now, and as the panel's arriving, we'll do the video first.
During Thanksgiving week in 1999, United Methodist Women joined Third World Nations and 70,000 people in Seattle concerned about the World Trade Organization and to challenge abuses against children, workers, farmers, and the environment. United Methodist Women and our predecessor organizations have always been involved in reforming institutions and responding to greed and oppression. We've tackled such challenges as lynching and child labor in the United States, the struggle of farmers and farm workers, civil rights, and apartheid in South Africa, for democracy here and democracy abroad.
United Methodist Women have worked for all of the life of the women in the church as an organization to speak on behalf of human rights for everyone. And a million members of United Methodist Women are standing behind me today.
God gives his people love.
Why are the United Methodist Women involved in the issues surrounding the World Trade Organization? We have selected three important issues to explore: small farms in crisis, genetic engineering of food and seeds, and democracy and human rights in Burma and the U.S. As we join those who are burdened by the wrongs of the system, United Methodist Women know what is required of us: to do justice and love kindness and walk humbly with our God. The World Trade Organization is made up of representatives of 134 member nations. It claims a single goal: to cut tariffs that corporations pay to countries as they move their goods and services around the world, removing all barriers to what they call free trade.
Forming a WTO then enables the countries to get together and say, look, my taxes are a little bit too high on your exporters, yours are too high on mine. We could both win if we could lower our tariffs a bit. And so they get together and say, well, I don't want to lower my tariffs alone, but if you do it with me, then both of our exporters will be better off, and the tariffs can be reduced in a fashion that leads to greater economic growth and better economic performance.
The World Trade Organization, in my view, and I think in the view of tens of thousands of people who are in Seattle and who have gathered and who have spoken on this matter, is really an institution that is set up to make it possible for multinational corporations, wherever they are, in whatever country, to make a killing, to make a profit with very, very little expenses to them.
The World Trade Organization, unfortunately, does not recognize workers' rights, human rights, environmental quality principles. The whole existence of the WTO is to facilitate trade and not to look at any other issue.
It's a mistake to think of trade as a zero-sum idea, that my gain is your loss. The purpose of the WTO is for all of the member governments to gain by the reduction of tariffs and the joint benefit to both countries that follows from that. That's why it's a consensus organization where agreements are reached by consensus and benefits are spread across members, in theory anyhow.
When these countries are trading together, it is not an equal. It may be a level playing field. Maybe the rules are all the same, but there's skill, there's size, there's experience. There are all kinds of things that factor into that.
They claim that they can introduce free trade, and the question is free for who or at whose expense. All those things are not favorable for subsistence farmers who produce raw material which doesn't have value. They cannot compete in the open market. They do not have access to those markets they claim to be creating.
Somebody explained it to me a while back, and in the way that made the most sense to me, and say, it doesn't really matter how level the playing field is. If it's a basketball court and you're on it with Michael Jordan, not going to make very much of a difference.
The decision making of the WTO excludes the developing African countries and the other least developed countries, and that's a problem. And if it's going to be dominated by the US and the G7, what do they know about trade in Africa, about poverty in Africa? What do they really know?
The African continent is the richest in the world, yet its people have been ravished and devastated by slavery, colonialism, greed, and thievery. The situation of subsistence farmers and their families is critical.
Traditionally, you grew enough to eat and sold the surplus. And you sold the surplus in the local markets. But over the years, there have been changes because of the macroeconomic policies, and especially because of liberalization. That means that whatever is now cultivated, the policy is to cultivate in order to export. Around the Lake Victoria are communities, and most of their lives they've lived off the lake. And a number of them happen to be women who have small boats, and they go into the lake and fish, cut just enough fish to sell in the market and to eat at home. With liberalization, suddenly that kind of farming was opened up to large fishing farms. And these fishing farms, of course, connect with the businessmen within the private sector in our countries. And they come in and they take all these large fish, taking away both the market and the source of livelihood and food for the communities there.
Who has the ships, the planes, the superhighways, the trucks, the marketing strategies, the media monopoly, and the billions of dollars in government subsidies to penetrate the market? Not the small farmer.
What's the capacity of a Ugandan fisherwoman to export her fish? She does not have the capital to transport that fish into the city, to the airport. She does not have the money to put that fish in a refrigeration so that it maintains its freshness. She doesn't have that. She cannot access loans from the bank because this rural woman, first of all, doesn't even have the information. She doesn't have anything in terms of collateral to give to, you know, to the bank. The interest rates are very high. Third, she doesn't know how to read and write, so how will she access the information? It's like the WTO is saying, trade is the thing, And indirectly they are saying, we don't care what happens to you, whether you die, as long as we are able to trade. How can you put trade above people? How can you put trade above their livelihood, their dignity? It's really sinful, if you think about it.
Women of faith have a special concern for farmers all over the world. Jesus said, "Feed my sheep," and demonstrated how a small amount of food distributed fairly provided plenty for all. 70% of the world's farmers are women, and even in the United States, 50% of the farmland is owned by women. This makes the role of the United Methodist Women central as we challenge the greedy and try to serve a dinner table large enough for everyone.
The concept of family farming, which this country was founded on, has to do with community. It has to do with people. It has to do with people who are an economic unit on the land, participate in the community by going to the schools, by going to the churches, by making a living.
Denise O'Brien is a United Methodist woman and an Iowa farmer who practices sustainable agriculture.
We do grow food for ourselves and for our community. We grow it for my relatives, for my in-laws, for my father. I am from a large family of 8 kids, and I also raise the apples and the strawberries and the raspberries, and that are all for public sale. The impact of the WTO on my farm life and our community in that is that we've gone from a diversified type of agriculture where you do hay and oats and corn and soybeans, where you have a crop rotation, where you break the cycle of pests and diseases and that, to strictly a monoculture of corn and soybeans. And then you have to rely on heavy use of chemicals, and it fouls the air and the soil and the water. And actually in Iowa, most of the water is undrinkable if it wasn't treated in the treatment plants. The WTO is set up to the advantage of agribusiness industry, and it's helping the concentration of the seeds and the chemicals into that of very few hands in agribusiness. And so what it's coming down to, what's in the near foreseeable future, is that farmers will only be driving the tractors on their land, that all of the resources that come off their land will be owned by the corporations, from the seed to the final product. And so what is made to look like a free market economy is basically a restrictive, non-free market.
The patenting of life forms is a crucial issue in the debate over the World Trade Organization. The United States produces most of the genetically modified food products in the world, and yet, increasingly, countries are refusing to buy it. Citizens of the European Union, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan refuse to purchase genetically altered foods, subjecting their countries to harsh sanctions by the WTO for hampering free trade.
What genetic engineering does is it, for the first time, goes across species. For example, to take a gene from a flounder and insert it into a tomato to make the tomato more weather resistant. Now, in nature, we know that a tomato cannot reproduce with a flounder, but in a laboratory, a tomato and a flounder can become one. It raises questions. Can't be called hybridization. It's something entirely new.
Some corporations argue that chemicals and genetically altered seeds are essential if we are to feed the world.
There's a fallacy in that reasoning about feeding the world and having to use chemicals. If we went organically, that people would starve. If we didn't use biogenetics, if we didn't use the GMO, the genetically modified organisms, people would starve. And the fallacy in that is, right now in this world, at this very time, there is enough food produced for people. It's the distribution, it's the wars, it's the dictatorships, it's those that are preventing people from getting food.
While United States supermarket shelves are overflowing, we have no way of knowing which of these foods are genetically altered.
The ultimate goal of labeling is to give consumers the right to know how their food is made, what's in the food they're eating. If it could be said that we are what we eat, then it would be wise to know what's in the food we're eating so we know what we're to become. The conflict is that the biotech industry doesn't want any labeling at all.
Dennis Kucinich, congressman from Ohio, has introduced a bill calling for the labeling of genetically altered foods. The corporations say that such labeling would violate World Trade Organization rules, creating a barrier to free trade.
People have a right to know what's in the food they eat. And it's a human right. If trade does not promote human rights, then we have to change the trade laws.
On March 22, 2000, the United Methodist Women, together with the Free Burma Coalition, organized a prayer vigil on the steps of the Supreme Court. The United Methodist Women endorse a Massachusetts law which supports the rights of citizens to restrict their purchases from corporations that do business in Burma, where slave labor is an open secret. Jesus told the parable of the rich man who walked past the beggar on his doorstep, whose wounds were being licked by dogs. The poor man asked for help, but the rich man ignored him and was condemned forever as a result. What is our role as we challenge the greed of our neighbor and try to respond to the needs of the beggar?
Well, it's nice to see so many people out here today. This issue is not just about democracy in Burma. That's very, very important, and all of us want to see democracy in Burma.
Yeah.
Equally important, this issue is about democracy in the United States. The Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers, they say it doesn't matter about human rights, it doesn't matter about democracy. The only thing that matters is that businesses have a right to do commerce and to have quote-unquote free trade. That is the only value that matters. But some of us have a different perspective. We believe that human rights and dignity and decency matter also.
Lord, I couldn't hear nobody pray.
Well, I've truly been appalled about the information that has been coming out of Burma in regard to servitude or slavery, I would call it, where people work on building roads and railways, and people are chained together. It seems that it really is something that we thought we had come beyond, but that it's really still present.
The government of Burma presses over 5.5 million people into service over in the past decade, and those are their numbers. That's 11% of their population. Do you know how many slaves there were in the United States in 1860? 11% of the population. So it's not a trifling subsidy. It's a government that wants to compete in terms of its economy and international trade based on a slave-type subsidy, and that obviously raises moral concerns for anybody doing business in Burma. Massachusetts says no.
The state of Massachusetts has passed the so-called Burma Law, which provides for selective purchasing laws relating to corporations that would do business with Burma. Massachusetts wants to discourage any corporations from doing business with Burma. That law has been challenged before the WTO, and it's also before the United States Supreme Court right now.
The procurement agreement simply says that governments can buy based only on price and performance. We can't take into account human rights considerations, environmental considerations, job creation, or labor protection when you buy goods and services. And of course, the vast majority of states, 47 by my count, have all kinds of laws, well over 150 laws, that express preferences for buying goods and services, not only including human rights, like the Massachusetts Burma Law, but also recycled content, for example, packaging that doesn't put toxic materials into the waste stream, preferences for small businesses, minority-owned or women-owned businesses, and of course, human rights like the Burma law.
The WTO is an organization that's designed and constructed to work with trade liberalization. That's its goal, and it's been very successful with that. To try to bring in a number of other issues into that same umbrella is risky. It might, the whole house of cards might shake a little bit.
If the World Trade Organization had existed in the late 80s and in the early 90s, when we were fighting against apartheid, South Africa would still be under apartheid, because we do believe, and many South Africans share this belief, that it was the sanctions that finally, that economic incentive, if you will, that finally broke the stranglehold of apartheid.
States put their values where their money is all the time. It's a long, healthy, and very active tradition. Some people are concerned that the impact of the WTO agreements might even be broader than purchasing and might include any kind of state regulatory power that affects the environment or labor, for example. So this case might actually have ramifications for those areas as well.
If we lose this case, what it means is that when young people and all people throughout this country say to their local and state governments, stand up and do the right thing, then the governors and the attorney generals will say, we can't do it. The big money interests tell us we can't do it. So I applaud this lawsuit, and I applaud your activism. Let us stand with the people of Burma. Let us stand with the people of the United States, and let's continue our fight for democracy. Thank you.
I think there are a lot of misunderstandings about the WTO. I think it's often viewed as a separate, powerful force run by corporations behind closed doors, looking out to advance producer interests with no interest on world welfare. But I would invite opponents or people who share that view to keep in mind that the WTO, and before it GATT, came in the wake of a disastrous global economic performance and the Depression and a World War II, and was viewed very much as an instrument through which to promote greater cooperation among governments and countries to achieve better economic performance, to achieve more peace even.
I think we can have economic growth and the growth of human rights and the growth of workers' rights in this country. As a matter of fact, it could be argued that the only way we can really have economic growth that is sustainable is to make sure that you have workers' rights.
My grandmother raised 10 children on a coffee farm that she still has. All her children are grown now, but we, the grandchildren and her children, are supporting her now because the coffee doesn't bring enough for her to survive on. She raised 10 children on that same amount of coffee. And that's the kind of situation where people are going, well, you know, the global economy is booming. How come I'm not doing so well?
The WTO does not exist for purposes of celebrating democracy. The WTO exists for the purposes of celebrating money.
This system doesn't work. Not for the majority of people, not for the majority of countries, and something needs to change.
In terms of the Burma conflict per se, every stage of tension or conflict between the corporations and the people is going to fuel organizing and motivate people like me and hundreds of Burmese expatriates and thousands of Americans who care about sovereignty and trade, or who care about the relationship between trade and human rights.
If there's foods that we can get locally, we should buy locally. I'd say go to farmers markets and buy food, and look at creating a direct link between the food provider and the food buyer.
You can purchase in the market now rugs that have a label on them, rug mark, that indicates that no child was employed in the making of this rug.
We are working as an African Women's Network to make sure that everybody who is affected by economy knows what economy is and how it operates. And we're doing that by training women in economic literacy, using even action education methods. Not using the economic jargon and complicated language, because that, there's so much that the economists hide under that language. But when they simplify it, basically, Every woman in the rural household is an economist.
The gains should exceed the losses in total, economic theory tells us, as we allocate production more efficiently across the different trading members. That is not the same thing as saying losers do not exist. They do. So one role for domestic government is to assist the losers, the people in domestic import competing firms who are suffering from this tariff liberalization process.
The one thing that I would like to add is on the obligation and the responsibility of people who live in the United States to understand what is being done in their name as taxpayers by their government and by institutions that are controlled or heavily influenced by the US government. And with that realization, their obligation to change the system.
You cannot put trade above people. That has to change. And we have to begin looking at people and looking, making sure that the economy meets the needs of the people and serves the needs of the people, rather than having the market determine, how can the market decide for me what my need is? You know, how can the market solve everything? What is that god or goddess?
We are all here, not just for ourselves, but we're here for each other. We're here for people who we've never met, who are brothers and sisters in other countries, who are hoping that we have the conscience and the moral fortitude to object to policies which undermine human dignity and deny people their basic human rights.
The work of the United Methodist Church is about people recognizing that and wanting to change the system. And that perhaps is the greatest work that people can commit to. And the message here is for people to work in all the places that they can to make sure that the system changes.
We can challenge the powers that force farmers off their land, permit slave labor, and force children to work. We must work together if we want the labeling of genetically altered food. We must demand that third world debt be canceled without conditions. The harm to the so-called losers must be borne by the corporate winners, not impoverished governments. We insist on our right as citizens to put our money where our values are. We are not saying no to trade. To have fair trade, we must have fair trade rules. We want the kind of trade rules that help build equity and fair distribution of the world's wealth. A good life for all. Our next step is to make our concerns known to all who will listen. Talk with our neighbors. Together, we are a million women, and our voice is strong.
God gives his people strength. If we believe in his way, he's swift to repay all those who bear the burden of the day. God gives his people.
Women, and that was not a commercial for United Methodist Women, but I felt it was important because one of the things that I've learned is that the World Economic Forum created the World Trade Organization. It was conceived at the World Economic Forum, which is the kind of thing that they're doing this weekend. Who knows what else they're going to try to saddle us with next. So I thought it was important, sort of a way of seeing some of the issues around trade, which is the main thing that the U.S. government is pushing all around the world, and it's the only resolution that they have for world poverty, which doesn't work. It's very clear that it's a failed idea. In fact, the disparity between people's wealth and wages
has grown greatly in the 10 years since we've been in this system. So we know it doesn't work, and we have to come up with other solutions from the bottom, I think. So part of what we're going to do tonight is talk about some of the models that we're working with in our communities, our congregations, our towns, our cities, our countries. We have people here from 4 countries at least. And so we'll talk some about what's happening in our communities in terms of global exploitation and what can we do about it. I put the Burma cards back there because it's one of the things that we have done as a community to respond to the issue of Burma. And since we started doing these, we're going to the stores and saying to them, here's a Burma product, I accidentally bought it, I don't want to see this in the store. And talking to the managers about it, and also calling on Congress to do what they should do about purchases from Burma. What we've learned is that about 28 international corporations have pulled out of Burma since this campaign started about a year ago. With a lot of organizations, we're not the only one, but it's something that is working. So what I'm going to do is just introduce to you this wonderful group of people. On my far left is Imam, let me see if I can pronounce it, Johari Abdul Majik.
Malik.
He's Malik, I think it's misspelled here. Among many other things, he is a chaplain at Howard University, and you should go to his website. He has this tremendous history, and we're very happy to have him with us. And we have Sister Sharon, I'm looking again, this is very, very tiny, Sister Sharon Altendorf, right? And she's with the Presentation Sisters, works her work for the Presentation Sisters is at the United Nations with ECOSOC, the Economic and Social Council. And on my right is Martha Benavides from El Salvador, a very good friend, and someone who has worked particularly on sustainable development issues. And she'll say more, I'm sure. And Donna Katzen, who was a stalwart fighter for justice in the South Africa issue as we were trying to get rid of apartheid in South Africa. And she now works with an organization called Shared Interest, and she'll tell you more about that. And Decima Williams, who is a professor at Brandeis, and was the ambassador to the Organization of American States during the New Jewel period in Grenada. And Jason Tainglet, from whom I just met tonight, who is from the Philippines, and he'll tell you more about what he's doing. We're not going to do speeches. We're going to do just a quick, each person say a little bit about things that you think are working, and then we'll talk to each other. It's a round table. And you all can get into it at some point, too. So,
if you're aware of what happens at the UN working as an NGO, that gives you a sense of what's going on. My group is an international organization. We are in 40 different countries. And we decided that probably the best way that we could work for systemic change was through working here at the UN. So we began this only in the millennium year, 2000. We have just begun. But I'm pleased to say that some of the things that have been important to us is the sharing of information of what is going on in different parts of the world. My partner is someone who lives in Brisbane, in Australia. And she's the communicator with each one of what we call a justice person, contact person, in different parts of all of these countries, should I say. And so they feed into each other what's going on in their areas and what they'd like us to work on. And from here in the UN, we pass the word to them too. That's what's going on. I'm pleased to say that Donna is part of one group that's called the Socially Responsible Investment, where our monies that are given for pensions, what we have, our monies are put into investments that will be for good purposes with very low interest, probably zero interest, and maybe she'll say something about that too. But we're into that as a result of this too. The other thing I was thinking of is that our people have participated in some of these UN forums in different places. We've had people who go to Geneva to speak about human rights, because our issues are basically women and children, human rights, indigenous peoples, and sustainable environment. So all of those issues, depending upon what's going on in the different countries. So maybe I'll stop there. Thank you.
First, beginning in the name of Allah, the most gracious and the most merciful. I'm very honored to be with you tonight. I pray that I will say something which is of benefit, but I'm sure that something of benefit will come out of this meeting. There is a saying of the Prophet Muhammad, whenever he wanted to emphasize something that he was about to say, he would tell his companions, "I swear by the one in whom my life is in his hands," to give gravity to what he's about to say. And so, to remind you that in the Quran, where we have over 1.5 billion people of the Islamic faith, almost an insignificant number of them are outside of the developing world, that those people subscribing to this belief, their understanding from the Quran is that the purpose of life is not trade. That the purpose of life is to serve our Creator, to make everything that we do a form of worship, whether that worship is by working, whether that worship is by caring for our neighbor, whether that worship is standing up for justice. But if we are doing those things for our Creator, then all of them are worship, not just praying. There is a oft-repeated verse in the Quran, "Inna alladhina amanu wa amilu salihati," those who believe and do deeds of righteousness. And so there is a connection and an important work that people of faith have to do, that work of righteousness. So in my brief comments, I just wanted to say one that I think it's important in the wake of 9/11. A tragedy, no doubt, but something that has galvanized and awakened the world again. Because many of us, and I can say many of us who have been traditionally thought of as being on the left, I don't know what happened to many of them. I remember them, Decima, when we were organizing around South Africa and when we were having many demonstrations about Grenada and so on. We were there. And then somehow or other we got separated from that work of righteousness. If we want to ask the question, what are we doing right? One of the things we're doing right is meeting tonight. And meeting tonight in the right way. And getting in touch with our true values. The other thing that I think is an important model for us to look at is that many countries who have been forced by sanctions have developed models of reliance, self-reliance, rather than dependence. I can give you the example. If we look in Africa, 250 million Africans are Muslim. And so now the war on terrorism also is a risk in their economies. But if I could look at a country, say, like Sudan. Sudan, after being listed as a terrorist state, was no longer eligible to borrow money. And so they became self-reliant. And they began trading with partners, not in Europe, but with partners in other parts of Africa. And so they went from an economy that was producing commodities for European consumption, for which they could not feed their own people from them, to an economy that would allow it not only to feed its own people, but to export to the region. I could give you an example of Somalia, a country which is also majority Muslim, in which Somalia has moved to the level where it has no functioning government. Therefore, it cannot borrow money, and it cannot be involved in the international trade agreements. And Somalia is beginning to develop economically to support itself in the absence of a functioning government. I'm not an anarchist. I'm saying to you that it is possible for societies to develop, and Somalia is developing technologically without being involved in this kind of arrangement. I believe there is a reference in the Bible that encourages us to be neither lender nor borrower. Because in that trade, there is something about it. We call it in Islam usury, riba, interest, where the rate of return is so much higher than the rate of goods and services. When that happens, something is wrong. I will say that many of these issues, like the issue in Burma, is an issue that I will take back to my community to get on board and do some investigation and get involved. I think this is the most important part of our gathering tonight. By the way, my mother's here, I think. I think she's here somewhere.
I saw some.
Okay, I see her hand is waving.
Welcome, and there are more chairs up here.
What I think that is a problem now is the use of euphemisms like the war on terrorism. I'm all against terrorism. But when it becomes a euphemism for going into countries and altering the economic structure so that it will be favorable to the West, that means it will be favorable for development. That we have, unfortunately, in the quote West, established a relationship that says we will support dictators over democracy in the name of economic stability. Islamic countries, they are more dictatorships and monarchies than they are representative of their own people. And when they try to establish a new economic model, a new social and political model like Algeria, duly elected individuals will have the government overthrown because it's going to change the former business relationships. I'm going to close and just remind us that there is an important difference between development and debt. That somehow or other the equation is that if a people are going to develop, they have to immediately go into debt. And so they sell the birthright of their nation in exchange for perhaps commodities which they don't even need. I don't know why everybody needs the internet. Why every home should have a computer when there are people around the world who cannot feed themselves and don't have potable water. So perhaps it is that we should look at these other relationships. And I'm saying to you, as we work together, particularly with our faith commitment, I am sure without a doubt we will put the commands of our Creator before the obligations to our creditors, that Allah will cause us to create a society that is based on justice and to establish peace. If we don't have economic peace, there will be no peace. Thank you so much. I'm going to turn it over and perhaps we can follow these subjects in the question and answer period.
Okay. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The idea with this panel is that there is a common understanding that globalization is not doing or is not benefiting the majority of the people. So I think that some of you may be in this room since this morning, so more or less we have been bombarded with all those statistics and data on the negative impact of globalization to us all. And maybe we could really focus more on what is working and what is not, which is the main idea behind this panel. In thinking of what is working and what is not, we cannot escape the reality of the impact that the Jubilee movement has created in recent years. So we all know how it all came about from this call of forgiveness of the Christian faith. But the good thing of this movement is it has transformed itself to become a very dynamic anti-debt, anti-globalization, and economic justice movement worldwide. It has been successful in terms of public awareness it has created worldwide. And of course, in the active involvement of some sectors of society, which you don't usually see on rallies or on the streets. We have movie stars, especially Bono, who else? And of course, the involvement of the church sector was very, very important. At the same time, it has expanded greatly the international campaign on debt and poverty, and reinvigorated people and organizations like us who have been in the debt movement for some decades now. I may look young, but I have been in this business for some time. And of course, at least we have forced the international financial institutions to respond to the demands of debt relief and cancellations. Of course, a lot of work is still to be done, since what we all have right now are HIPCs, or the Repackaged Poverty Reduction Strategy paper. So we still have really some work done. I will not go through the details of this paper. It's entitled The Hands That Rock the Purses and Local Markets. It's available at the back for those who would want some information. But I would just like to make two points that I think we must discuss tonight. One is with regards to Argentina. It is quite appalling to hear White House, your president, or the IMF, which is also here in the States, saying that Argentina's problem was its refusal to further liberalize because of its inefficient state industries. When I hear George Bush or the IMF, I can only think of that character in the Bible, Pontius Pilate. So, yeah, George Bush and his like they're acting like modern day pilots, washing their hands, when in fact they are as responsible as the past military and civilian regimes of Argentina. It is the IMF and World Bank that has implicitly tolerated the corrupt procurement of loans by past governments and nationalized private debts and incorporated them into public debts. During the military regime, billions of dollars of private debts were made public. The absence of regulation over foreign creditors from 1976 to 1983 led to an increase in Argentina's debt from 7.8 billion to 46 billion, consisting 20% of Argentina's total debt. So, I mean, I can go on, but it's quite obvious. They are not as clean as they want themselves to project. They are as responsible as the past governments of Argentina. And last point that I would also like to touch on is with regards 911. We cannot overemphasize 911 if it means restricting our rights, curtailing our movements, or sabotaging our mobilizations in the guise of anti-terrorism measures. Surely those who benefit from globalization would very well want to wrap us in the same terrorist veil. Hence, the need to be vigilant remains as important as ever. Now, it depends on us on how we view vigilance. It may be strict tactics, it may be more lobbying, etc., etc. It's up to us. But the point is, now more than ever, the vigilance is much needed. At the same time, free trade agenda is taken on board the anti-terrorism bandwagon. Your U.S. Secretary of State or U.S. Secretary of Trade calls on the international community to use free trade to combat terrorism. The new round of WTO negotiations, according to Robert Zoellick, are being justified in the same vein. More of free trade is allegedly needed to eradicate terrorism. The war on terrorism certainly goes far beyond the label the U.S. government has put on its latest offensive. It is in fact part of the whole political military offensives that serves its hegemonic designs, blah, 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 blah. George Bush wants to turn the situation into a political bonanza. I'm not a Democrat, so it doesn't matter to me anyway. He is playing the anti-terrorist paranoia and is wrapping the American flag to cover up the deepening crisis of the U.S. and the world economy. I'm also tempted to say that, but I leave that to other speakers. The specific political agenda in Afghanistan is almost complete. The defeat of the Taliban and the installation of a friendly regime. The projection of U.S. military might and deployment of military forces in the region where American influence is traditionally weak. It is quite appalling that they're talking of war on terrorism and almost 1,000 soldiers are now in the Philippines in the guise of fighting the so-called Al-Qaeda network. But historically, if you look at this so-called network of Al-Qaeda, they are CIA trained. They are friends of the CIA during the Cold War in Afghanistan. So anyway, this is the so-called war on terrorism. It is a war not only forced on us third world people, but I think most importantly to you American people. It includes justifying and putting into place the worst hegemonic designs, blah, 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 blah. And especially here in the States, new security measures have been put into place, supposedly as a reaction to September 11. But they threaten civil liberties of American citizens that it curbs, done more than it curbs terrorism. This assault on civil liberties and attendant witch hunt is directed on a wide range of individuals, groups, organizations opposed to these policies. And just last month, a new trade act was passed here in the States, if I remember it right. And more than us, it also would affect you. Before coming in, there was a note that I got from the internet that says non-US citizens have an option either to join or not to join the street protest, because there's this new patriotic act that would make non-US citizens highly targets of just coming in. I can imagine, you know, the fortress around the UN compound and also the World Economic Forum. I mean, I can just imagine. They said that this new act, in the guise of war on terrorism, can be imposed on us, and that they cannot guarantee our liberty. So they said to us, it's an option if we want to join the protest or not. Anyway, I will still join. As it is, we must not let those... thanks. As it is, we must not let those who benefit and profit from international economic and social order to hide under the ashes of September 11 and still have their way. We must dust off September 11 for the world to see the real problem, and that is the worsening crisis in the international community brought about by globalization. The people's anger must be brought or must be put where it should be. Those responsible for September 11 must be dealt accordingly, but it should not be at the expense of masking the severe economic crisis and social discord brought about by neoliberal policies. At the same time, there is every need to expose the current U.S. military adventurism in full display. Let me end by saying, now more than ever, it is a must for us all. Faith-based movements, labor unions, anti-debt campaigners, anti-WTO networks, anti-IMF World Bank think tanks, environmental groups, development institutions, NGOs, human rights advocates, peasant movements, peace movements, students, social activists, individuals, you, me, you, all of us here, to integrate our work and coordinate our efforts, leaving no issues unattended, working in unison as much as possible while recognizing the diversities and accepting the differences in approaches of all the group, and at the same time, never ceasing to pursue innovative approaches. A vibrant regional movement or network to complement the national and international campaign is worth pursuing. At Doha, it was quite clear that there was a missing link at Doha. And the missing link was that it is the indispensability of national movements, because it is here where we build the necessary political strength to confront unjust system. Clearly, there is still no substitute to movements on the ground in all countries, whether be it in the US, in the Philippines, or anywhere else in the world. The national level presents to us the weak link in the rule of global finance capital and unhampered trade, because it is here where we build the real political strength. At Doha, the developing countries were not able to survive the pressures. It was reported that the US, using direct threats, warned Haiti and the Dominican Republic to cease opposing the position of the US government or risk canceling their preferential trade agreements. This is important because while we all do our lobby work here at the UN level or in Geneva, the WTO, it is still important that the national movement, the pressure on the ground, because it is the pressure on the ground that will force our respective governments if they would still give more compromises or not. National movements and campaign lobby work must further be linked, connected, and fused. Only a strong, persistent, and unrelenting social movement that arouses and mobilizes the local population to put pressure on their governments can make these same governments, be it the Philippine government or your government here in the States, to think twice before making further concessions or compromising positions to the detriment of their people or the national interest. The painstaking efforts of NGOs and other civil society groups to assist developing countries, be it at the WTO or UN or IMF, to gain better understanding of the technical or political nature of issues, like what the ecumenical team is doing in most UN summits, the WCC ecumenical team, just like what they're doing, must be continued and, if possible, further be linked at the national movements of the respective countries. In many instances, positions of governments and social movements have not always been similar. In the end, we need to do all of this and much more. And through all these efforts, we hope to encourage more people, build more alliances, build more networks, build more movements that will join us in putting an end to the neoliberal order. In so doing, we can finally take out the immoral hands that wrap the bourses and trade markets and put it back to the sovereign hands of the people, who will decide their own economic paths and national development policies while engaging in genuine partnerships. The video presentation was quite good. We all want trade. We all want development, but the trade that we want is one which is fair, one which treats us as co-equals, one which is in an atmosphere of fair, non-discriminatory, transparent, and just. Thank you very much.
I'd like to just, does this work? Yeah, it does. I'd
like to just shift the focus for a minute. We're talking about what works. And clearly looking at the history of faith-based organizations, we can look at the many kinds of strategies that people have used throughout the years in this country and around the world, ranging from prayer to reflection to study to activism to advocacy to work on policy, a whole range of tools. I wanted to just throw one more tool into the bag here and talk a little bit about not only becoming active advocates, but also actors, economic actors within the global community. And one of the very interesting trends that we've seen in the last couple of decades is that religious institutions, faith-based institutions, are beginning to use their own economic power on the side of the people's economies of the world, or the people's economy of the people's organizations of the world. That is to say, not only criticizing and not only analyzing what is wrong with global trade, with the debt crisis, but beginning to partner with people's economies and people's organizations around the world. Just in a little more specific context, South Africa is a really interesting example because it shows the continuum of strategies that faith-based organizations have used over the years. And we remember in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the faith-based organizations partnering with South African religious institutions, the South African Council of Churches, Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference, the Islamic organizations, the Jewish organizations, the Buddhist organizations in the country, who together called for economic pressure as the last hope for peaceful change to overthrow apartheid without a bloodbath. And so faith-based organizations around the world rallied to that cry and learned in the process that they too had economic power. Despite vows of poverty that people had taken, despite broken down and impoverished churches, synagogues, mosques, they discovered together that they had some economic power themselves and the ability to use that muscle to get cities, states, campuses, trade unions to exercise their economic power for change. Interesting thing happened in 1994 when South Africa became a democracy. And that is that many of those faith-based organizations that had worked very hard to get their money out of South Africa began to say, we would like to put our resources, whatever we can mobilize, ours and others, behind the development of a more just economy in South Africa that we have fought very hard for with our brothers and sisters in South Africa. And so there, many vehicles have been created. The one that I work with was created largely by the faith community. And it sought to mobilize people's investments, people's loans, but not to put that money into the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, to find a way, thank you very much, and not to create worse debt, not to hang South Africa up on international debt that it would have to repay in dollars, which is really not a favor, as we know, to any country. And so the mechanism that we have created, and there are similar mechanisms like this all over the world, I'm only using this as an example, is a mechanism where people use their own capital in the United States as a way of getting South African banks and others to lend to the people who have been redlined, the people who have been marginalized, the people for whom borrowing was illegal in South Africa for all of these years. And we're not just talking history here, because whereas in the United States we complain that one out of every five people has no access to banking services, one out of five people has no access here. In South Africa, one in every five people does have access to banking services. And it's still that way 7 years after the end of apartheid. And so I'm using this as an example of a growing movement for community investment. And that is people largely in countries that have resources to invest, putting their money into people's economies in their own communities and in communities like theirs. We know them in the United States and in other countries through community development loan funds, credit unions, the kinds of organizations that help people keep capital in their own communities and using it to chart the course of their own development. It is not only possible to do that at home, as many faith-based organizations are recognizing, but it is also possible to do that overseas. And a broad range of organizations are doing this. Fonds Cosé in Haiti, the NICA Fund in Nicaragua, the Grameen Bank, Bangladesh, I mean, countries all over the world, Some organizations invest in a number of countries and mobilize people's capital all over the world. Oikocredit, many of you remember the Ecumenical Development Cooperative Society, lends to co-ops all over the world that have difficulty getting credit from other sources and lend at low, at very inexpensive rates. Acción International lends all over Latin America, mobilizes credit all over Latin America so that low-income communities can start, create their own jobs, their own income-generating projects, build their own houses. Just to, what we're talking about doing here is building wealth without building dependency. These are not the kind of loans that say, if you borrow my money, you can get rich quick. We all know those models. We've been hearing about the World Bank. We've been hearing about the IMF. We're talking about mobilizing people's resources in their own communities. Just to give you one quick example, and we can talk more about this later when we get to the discussion, the way that we have ended up doing that in South Africa at Shared Interest is by creating a guarantee fund so that when people lend money to us here in the United States, we use it not to lend to people in South Africa, but in fact, we use it as collateral. We use it as collateral to get white banks in South Africa to lend to the black communities that they would otherwise consider the wrong color, the wrong gender, rural, never had a bank loan, no credit history, everything that makes somebody unbankable still today. And because there are guarantees from the United States, largely, and 60% of our money comes from the faith community, because there are people here to vouch for people's economies and people's organizations in South Africa, those organizations can now get access to credit for their own purposes. And it's credit on terms that they can afford, not for the purpose of becoming hooked on money from South African banks, but using that money to invest and becoming increasingly self-sufficient on their own. It's a very interesting mechanism. It's built on partnerships between faith communities here and in South Africa, and similar to models in other countries. And it also makes faith communities partners both in creation and in community. This is not a new tradition. People in the black churches in this country have known for years that those churches have invested heavily in their own communities. There have been Hebrew Free Loan Societies that made zero interest loans to help poor people in the community get up and started. A variety of mechanisms that have been endemic to economic justice traditions in this country and around the world. What is interesting now, just to flag it, is that in a time when we're talking about globalization, those same kinds of models can be very helpful at the international level. If we are talking about people's partnerships across borders, partnerships that don't create dependency, these same kinds of economic models can be extremely, extremely important to building the power of low-income communities. In the process, it is possible to avoid creating a debt trap and to build very strong people's organizations. I'll give you one example, and then I'll stop. In a very small rural town called Bushbuck Ridge in Northern Province, up by the Mozambican border of South Africa, a group of rural women who had no experience generating any kind of income for themselves had this whim. They decided they wanted to be commercial farmers. Unheard of. I mean, farming is a woman's occupation until somebody starts to get paid for it in South Africa, and at that point it is no longer a woman's occupation. Ditto building homes. So these women in Bushbuck Ridge went to a local NGO that grew out of the South African Council of Churches, and they said, we would like to become commercial farmers. This local NGO, which is now working to become a development organization, said, very good, we will find for you partners that have technology that will be useful to help you become successful. Who did they pick? They picked a group of white Afrikaner farmers in the area that 5 years ago would have had nothing at all to do with this particular group of people. And they somehow made this match. The old farmers taught the new farmers, the women, this innovative, sustainable agriculture technology. And the women are now growing so many tomatoes and so many peppers that in their first three-month growing season, 16 women and the other 64 women they've now hired produced 175 tons of tomatoes in 3 months. Now they get four growing seasons a year, so
You can do the math. If you lined up, trying to picture, we said, so what does that look like, 175 tons of tomatoes? And the math teacher in our group took it home to her group, and they figured out that if you lined up 175 tons of tomatoes next to each other, they would stretch 35 miles. So we're talking about not only tomatoes and not only economic power, but we are talking about changing the face of a community, one woman at a time. A woman who, several months ago when the project started, seemed very small, slight, retiring, said, did not speak, came up to me the last time I was there several months ago and said, don't you recognize me? My name is Ruth. Let me show you what I've done with my project. And she had five people working for her and growing tomatoes and had now begun to make a contribution to her community. That is an example of what people's economics can do with partners overseas. This is the point of all of this, is to say that community investment has tremendous potential. There is a campaign by the Social Investment Forum to get investors to put 1%, one tiny percent of their investments into these kinds of community investments at home and overseas that increase the power of low-income people in their communities. And if that were to happen, it would triple the number of dollars available for these projects automatically, simply with 1%. What it says is that while we think of ourselves as partners of the poor and partners of the powerless, we are neither poor nor powerless, because we can impact institutions, we can move capital, and we can move it in the service of our partners. I'll end with a quote from one of my very favorite South African street vendors, who said, political power and political freedom without economic freedom is not freedom. Lawrence Mavundla was right. It is our challenge to mobilize that power.
Okay. I'm going to see which of you is going to go. I know neither of you is shy.
Buenas noches. So put your ear. I want to know how many of you felt cold today? Coming here. Cold.
Cold.
Yes. You see, I am from Central America, from El Salvador. And it's supposed to be hot there, you know. But lately has been cold, while here has been warm. And we had a lot of people getting sick, you know. So in spite of, see, I want you to see a different way of thinking. You know, we can say that the weather is very bad outside, but you know, this is the weather of this season, you know, and it has to be like this, and we should be thankful, because if it doesn't work properly, you're not going to have what you have to have in the spring and in the summer, you know, and you won't be able to feed the people, there won't be enough water. So even though I would like not to feel cold, I am sorry that I am not feeling cold all the time here. And the reason I'm explaining this is because once we understand things, you know, we learn to respect and to behave as we, you know, as it's supposed to be. So I would like to stretch your minds with me. You see, we have gotten a lot of good food for thought right now. One of these things that we know, for example, in our country, in El Salvador, is that this whole thing about free trade is not new, and for sure it's not free, you know. But we know that this started at least 500 years ago, when Columbus got lost. But right around the time, they said that he discovered us, and all of you believed it. And so from there on, everything has been mixed up, and you believe in free trade, and you believe in freedom the way it's given to you, and you think that you have free speech, you know. All these kinds of things that you believe in here start from right around that time. So it's 500 years of having crooked thinking, you know. Now, we in El Salvador believe, you know, that we are supposed to be peons, because the colonizers came and colonized us. So everybody's colonized, because in order for the colonizer to colonize us, the colonizer had to colonize himself or herself, you know. In order for the colonizer to have slaves, had to be slavery inside, and think that that was right. And we have bought into this understanding. And right now, you know, we are told, be consumers, be a good consumer. But consumer is that it consumes, it destroys. There is nothing after. Fire consumes, you know. So, but we believe, yeah, be a good consumer. What is a good consumer? You go and know how to buy. But, you know, you have to buy a lot of things. Lots of stuff that you don't need. So we are saying, stop being a consumer, be a person. You know, go back to the origin. Understand that we, that's why person, you know, person is as per the son, or as per the daughter, I would say also now, you know. But as per the son is as per the son of God, or the spirit, the great creator. So we are as per the father, mother. So we are as creators at that. So what we have now, as humanity, you know, we are only one. There is only one energy. We, life doesn't come for different people from different places, you know. It comes for the one source. And everything that is here manifested, and what we haven't seen that is manifested, you know, because there are things that we don't see right now and are right here, you know. All those things come from the same energy source. So when we understand the oneness, we start also understanding and behaving different. So we know that we are one with the one that is the oneness. You know, once we know that we are the creator. So as humanity, we all have created this. But, you know, even if I don't like it, I am amazed at what we have created. Mm-hmm. And I say, if we have created that, we can create the ones that are our dreams. But a lot of time we use a lot of our energy to be in opposition only, to be in resistance only. Therefore, our frame of reference is that, and not, you know, I, who is the creator, who is part of that oneness, you know. And so a lot of my energy is focused into changing that and not creating that which I dream about. So one of the ideas in El Salvador with the people that we're working with, okay, we cannot, you know, be fighting about the 500 years, but we can right now, 500 years of, you know, all that mess upness. We have all that mess upness inside, you know. And so, but what we can do is say, who do we want to be? And let's start being now. And therefore, you resist and you oppose, but by your being, not by choosing to be just against this, but by creating also that which you really want. So if you're going to have a demonstration against something that's really, you know, unjust, all the time that you use to effectively work together, manifest the gifts of the creator, the spirit, be very creative, you know, be very, very creative. Have fun with it. You know, nature has had fun creating. That's why we have that biodiversity, because nature had fun. You know? Yes. And so we are supposed to be just like that too, you know? Have fun in life. So learn to laugh. We are feeling that it's too much. It's too much. In El Salvador, when things get to be too much, we go and talk hay, we say. And you know why what hay is for us? Shaft. You know? Shaft. So we say, oh, you are feeling really sick. Oh, I need to go and talk some hay, you know, some shaft. So we go under the tree and we start talking shaft. So whoever can come with the craziest idea, so that you even have to run to the bathroom because you cannot contain your laughter, then we have done a good job, you know, getting rid of all the crap. Not allow any to have it inside, you know. And that doesn't mean that you don't work with it. You work with it, but with a creative way. Not thinking that that contains you, but you contain that, you know? So you turn it around. So one of the things that we are saying is, you know, because people at home, when we have had a revolution, and believe me, we are still suffering for most of the majority of stuff that we were before. And that's where some of us started to question things, you know? And many of our friends were killed and all that. So we said, how is it that we have to live life now, you know, those of us that have been left here on Earth. Well, if we were here, you know, if we are left, we should have fun. So we are having this fun. So we said, how are we going to do these things now? First of all, we have to have the consciousness. Stop and think things through. You know, just don't react. Sometimes even the most progressive stuff that we are doing is reactionary because it's a reaction to this. But how do we manifest those gifts of the spirit, you know? So we have to know that we are conscious beings. And we have to start knowing also that we have been told lies. We have been told that we are mortal beings. No, we are eternal beings having this experience that goes through a step that we call death. You know, but we are eternal. So once you get all this understanding, you start being stop being afraid. And so we start saying, we can choose to be who we want to be, and then intentionally be conscious about things. Intentionally choose what we are going to do. Intentionally manifest the gifts of the Spirit, which is power. No, but we go around saying, we are going to empower women. You know, they keep telling that. And so I feel, oh, you're going to empower me. Huh? Okay, how is that? So that means that first of all, you have to take my power away. Because I am of the Creator and the Creator is power, therefore I'm power. And it's different that you work with me to remove the obstacles, you know, all that colonial stuff that make us feel and act powerless, than I am powerless. No, so we never go and empower anybody. When we understand that, then we won't go and say, oh, we will stop saying even things like, don't give a fish to somebody. Teach them to fish. And who do you think invented fishing? Yes. You did? No. You know, we all did. And all that we have to do is that we have gone through a process of colonialism that teaches us that we didn't know anything. You know? And so now in El Salvador, people are saying, oh, we can, we would love to do this, and why don't you do it? There is no, and they go like this. And you know what that, so I pretend that I don't know what it is, that, right? And I say, what's that? I don't know. Oh, you don't know? And then they even go to the pocket. There is no, that's money, you know? And I say, you saying that there is no money? Yeah, so we cannot do anything. Who created the money? God sent a lot from and they say, no. So who created the money? And then, you know, you go through the process of finding that we create the money as humans for, you know, to facilitate things. So this that is supposed to facilitate us now have us enslaved. Now we cannot do anything without money. And I say, no, pretend that we haven't invented money yet. Let's go and do this. Believe me, this is how I have to work in El Salvador, because otherwise, you know, people feel there is all this mess that we have, you know. So I want to tell you one thing, you know, even thanks God that, you know, Spanish is not my language, but it's my language. I mean, I am indigenous, and even though I look white, and you know, I had to learn to love the one that raped a family where, who knows when, you know, and then I'm the only one that looks white in the family. You know? But I had to learn that to love that person, because you know, otherwise I would hate myself. So I had to learn these things happen, and here I am, you know, and I even look in this in the mirror and I say, no, I look okay. You know, you have to learn not to switch you, but to understand. You have to open your heart, and you have to be brave and be thankful every day, because you know the whole universe is working so that you have air every day. So that's the other thing, that we don't think about the gratefulness. And I tell you, there are days in El Salvador that I wake up and I don't feel like saying thanks. Usually, I wake up about 4:30 in the morning and my heart opens up and I give thanks, you know? I am so thankful, just thankful. But then there are days that I cannot get up and I crawl, you know? And I start saying, but I know that the whole universe has been working so that I can be here today. And then, you know, I remind myself consciously about it, and then my heart opens up, and then I have the strength to sit down, and then be fullness in life, you know? So one last thing that I want to share with you. This whole process of, you know, this language is not mine, but then I have appropriated it. I don't know Nahuatl anymore, even though, you know, we have a lot of words from the Nahuatl language in Spanish now. And we use them, you know. But in Spanish, the word sustainable, the part able is ability. You know, that's what able is, ability. But sustainability. In English, you just have one word. Sorry for you, but then you're going to know the other meaning, and this is what is important, you know. In Spanish, for example, we can say sostenible or sustentable. Sostenible is that it can be held, you know, it can be maintained. It's like, you know, these legs sustain, you know, this board, and then it makes a table. That's sostenible. Also, you know, your underwear, women wear, you know, things that help to sustain certain parts of the body. Unless you figure out how, with exercise or whatever, you don't do it. Then that's sustentable. So for us, the other word, sustentable, is related to the word sustenance. That which provides sustenance, that feeds you, that nourishes you. So today at the UN, people are saying, Latin Americans say, no, we have to use the word sostenible, you know, the one that is just artificially in a sense, because that's the official language. And who created the official language anyway? I don't even believe that God created. We created, you know, with the wisdom, with the power that we had, but we sometimes get ourselves into these little boxes. So we cannot use sustentable. That helps us to think and to nourish and to have all the power of creativity because somebody else says that the official one is sostenible. So I'm asking all of us, you know, don't go away from here without understanding that all of life is sacred and look at it with reference, whatever is happening, and then look at not that you're going to change it, but how you're going to work with it in a creative way so that we affirm life. That really we affirm the principles of the ability for sustenance. You know, how do we do that? And so that we can be the creators that we are. Don't forget that. We are creators. That's the work that we are doing in El Salvador. We are doing a lot of things, but the one thing in education, if the UN knew it, in education, the Decade for Education of Culture of Peace, we are making sure that people know more than anything else we are creators, and therefore, enjoy it, but be responsible about it, you know? And so that's what I'm leaving with you.
Okay, definitely.
So now there's a little more to add. I have had a tremendous treat here already. More to come. I want to begin by thanking Marilyn and the Methodist women and the community of faith for organizing this forum. I gather you've been going all day. I haven't been on the web, so I don't know what has been posted there from the various. But I was this, I'm an incessant listener of National Public Radio. Sometimes I'm happy, and nowadays I'm quite unhappy, actually. But I was listening to it last night and thinking about this presence here. And there was a woman on the radio who was attending the World Economic Forum a few blocks from here. And let me preface it by saying, I think there are sort of three levels of conversations in this town now. Yes, there is the Economic Forum and perhaps paralleling it and twinning it with the UN. So that's one level, that international official level. Then there is us, you know, the Alternative Analysis, Alternative Action Forum. And then there is what we can more formally call the protest movement. Our brother here is going to be part of that as well. he thinks. Yes, we will prepare your bail. And in the radio report last night, a participant in the Davos Forum, and I could very much envision it because I once had the privilege of being in the World Bank IMF annual meetings, and it's like 5,000 world, you know, bankers and central bankers and finance ministers and so on, and there are four or five women in the whole thing. And so this NPR reporter got a woman from the Davos Forum to speak, and she was given various analyses and so on, and then she was asked, what is the, you know, how does she feel about the protesters in the street? And she said that protesters have something to say and we want to hear it. Her name is Lucy Marcus. She's with an outfit called Marcus Venture Consulting Firm. So I think everybody should get hold of Lucy Marcus here in New York and let her know what we have to say and certainly show our documentaries and so on. It was the first open invitation I had from the Davos Forum. And the notion of the public eye on Davos is therefore quite important, again, picking up on this theme that nobody controls the space for conversation. We've learned that over the years, that anytime there's an opportunity to speak or to act, we have to seize it, very much in keeping with the sentiments expressed by our colleague Martha. So this public eye on Davos is very, very important. Believe you me, they listen and they hear. So I hope we can speak up. The other thing I wanted to say is, Marilyn, when you opened, you said something about the WTO, and I just want to clarify a little bit that the World Economic Forum, which has been meeting in Davos, started 37 years ago. You know, it's old. I believe that it is part of these 1960s, 1970s institutions, like the multilateral, trilateral commission. Mm-hmm. And these.
Yeah, it's like that.
Yes, yeah. You know, they got started. And we have to remember them and link it to the current period, because now that we come to WTO, we think it comes out of nowhere. It doesn't. And it's linked to these, to Davos and Trilateral Commission in terms of the private sector, global economic institutions. Now, the WTO, on the other hand, is a direct outgrowth of the GATT. And that's a new creation. That's 94. It took 7 years to create the WTO from the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And why? Because, in fact, whereas the GATT was created in 1946, you had maybe 50 countries, mainly European powers, deciding on the arrangements in trade and institutional arrangements at the global level. By 1986, when they went to review in the Uruguay round, there were over 140 countries participating and making an input into this new structural formation. And it took very long, very intense negotiations, and as you see what we got, the WTO, almost from its inception in 94, but increasingly over the last few years, there's a tremendous amount of concern, both within it, I would say, and particularly outside of it, that the institution is seriously flawed. There's no doubt about that, that the WTO cannot deliver to the peoples of the world the kinds of protocol arrangements or regime management that will make for a democratic global economy. It just cannot. The rules are not written like that, and I'm not sure that I would agree that even the intentions were supposed to be there. But we know that it cannot. There is need for complete, comprehensive review of all these global architectural institution and policy arrangements. So I think that's the first thing to know, that, again, linked to what people have said on the panel so far. We are not powerless, we are not voiceless, we are not just to take what we are given. All these institutions have been created, and therefore we have to have a voice in arguing whether or not they're working and to propose an alternative. I want to make three quick points, having said that. One is that, and speak about my region. I come from the Caribbean region, and I will speak a little bit tonight about something that impacts the Anglophone small Eastern Caribbean islands in particular, and that is the global trade in bananas, which has been a staple domestic food as well as a staple export crop in the region. And so I actually would like to refer you to this documentary that is out a few months now called Life and Death. It's really, really worth seeing, buying, showing in your communities and so on. It really tells much more than we can hear today in terms of how in this period, you know, last year and this year, the international global economy is not working for vulnerable states and vulnerable peoples, which is what Jamaica and many of the Eastern Caribbean countries are in the context of global global economy. So my first point is that there is a major link between the following actors: the global economy, both its structure and its policies, the nature and the fortunes of the Caribbean economies today, there's also a link between that and gender roles and gender realities in the Caribbean. As a fourth part, there's a role to bananas, and there is a link to bananas, and a link to women, particularly poor women, who are often heads of their households. So the global economy, the Caribbean reality, gender roles, bananas, and women come together. And the short story is that it comes together in a way that is rather pernicious and disempowering for women in the banana sector in particular, but all those women and men in the societies who are impacted by the trade that these women and men engage in. Now, and I'll come back to that. I want to say secondly that this link is not a straight line. It's not so easy to untangle it. I take the view that globalization is an extraordinarily complex process. It's not that we can't understand it. We can, and we have, and I think there's been a tremendous amount of analysis from progressive sectors, from feminists, from unschooled people, from those who are both victimized by the global economy, right? So we understand it, but the thing that we've got to remember is that the relationships and linkages are very complex. And perhaps when we take them apart, we might take apart one particular strand, but it has relations to other pieces. So, for example, if you think about trade, it also has to do with production. It has to do with marketing. It has to do with who the actors are, where it's marketed. It's a whole very massive system. And at the same time, these links are formal links, but they are also largely informal. More and more, Donna spoke about already, that these informal links or alternative links that are opened up, in fact, by globalization through the technology. We are in a position, to benefit from the technology if, in fact, we can have control over it. So these, there are a large number of negative impacts that these linkages are causing for small banana farmer producers in the Caribbean who are men and women, but I want to speak about the women. What has happened is that their vulnerabilities in the system have been increased because incomes decline. Traditional incomes are declining because the banana trade, let me back up and talk a little bit about this banana trade. When you go to the store here, we see these beautiful, long, bright yellow bananas that never rot. We buy them, we take them home, they'll stay a week, 10 days, and as soon as they start to get a little bit brown, we throw them out because they're bad. We want the ones that look shiny and new. Well, those bananas are typically produced on a latifunda or on a plantation in Central America under conditions that we would not consider sustainable. The workers are paid anything from 5 cents on the dollar that banana sales would fetch. There's a fair amount of toxic pesticides put into the land for this rapid production. The conditions of the workers often mean that they're not allowed to unionize and so on. In other words, environmentally, socially, and economically, there is no justice or sustainability in it. But it produces a kind of consumerist food, right, that looks pretty. And so its competitor has been the Eastern Caribbean banana. It's also produced throughout the Caribbean in Jamaica, but particularly in Dominica, St. Lucia, St. Vincent, and Grenada. Now, those bananas are produced on small plots of land that are family-owned plots to begin with. Doesn't mean that every banana producer owns land, but a large percentage of the producers are landowners themselves. these bananas are produced under situations that use limited, I'm not saying we don't use any chemical inputs and pesticides, but very limited. In fact, we now have a tissue culture one that is supposed to use less and less pesticides. And the banana sector, the small banana producer in the Caribbean, has been a very empowered economic actor and has helped to transform from post-slavery conditions, because it's a cash crop and it's a crop that produces income every week or every 2 weeks when farmers take their produce to market. We've gotten on average 16 cents to the dollar, whereas our Latin American counterparts get 5 cents per dollar. But it's a very high cost food to produce. And in recognition of the ravages of colonialism and slavery, Britain made an arrangement with a group of countries called the ACP countries, Africa, the Caribbean, and Pacific countries, that the products that they produce will be received on the European market, the British market, under these preferential trade agreements, which was agreed to in Lome in 1975. And since 1975, bananas and other commodities enter onto the British market in a preferential way, so that farmers in the Eastern Caribbean were virtually guaranteed a market. Now comes the WTO and the ideology of free trade. No special arrangements, says the ideology, says, right? And so Chiquita do Del Monte, the international banana cartels, control 94% of the global banana trade. By the way, banana is the fourth most important agriculturally traded commodity. So it's big, big money. Coffee, sugar, bananas, coffee, tea, sugar and bananas. So they control 94% of the global market, but only 64% of the European market. So with the coming of this free trade regime, in 1994, Chiquita made a major contribution to the Clinton administration, and in 95 called in its chips by arguing that the arrangement between Europe and the ACP countries represented unfair trade advantage, and that had to go. And this, imagine. Now, this was litigated in the WTO for several years, and we now have an arrangement that is more or less, it allows the arrangement to continue until the year 2006. In 2006, the new arrangement comes in, which is free trade, open trade, winner take all, whoever comes in and is able to flood the market. So this is where you will come in later on, because it all depends on the consumers. Yeah. Now, in this transition then from preferential access to free trade rules under the WTO, the banana producers in the Caribbean have suffered. They've also suffered, I hasten to add, because the purchaser, the consumer, you and I over here, we have now decided we want this cosmetic looking bananas, you know? And therefore the production has suffered, farmers have lost their incomes, and the short story is, as I said, large numbers of men and women in these four very small countries in particular, and in other places like Jamaica, have lost their livelihood. There was a big demonstration in St. Vincent a couple of years ago by, I believe it was many former banana farmers who said, okay, so we can't send our bananas to the European market. What can we send? What about marijuana? That's a big cash crop to replace it. The women, on the other hand, it appears, have had a different experience. Men and women have gone into construction, tourism, other services where they can make a livelihood if they have the skills and so on. But I must tell you that a number of women, I understand that there's a tendency now to go into sex tourism, That's the alternative that we are being offered in parts of the Caribbean as a result of the decline of the banana sector. Now, what can we do then if there is this link between how the global economy treats small producers, who makes the rules, who has the consumer power, the fact that women in some of these some of our countries are single heads of household, and even when they are not, they are responsible for bringing in income into the household, and are now finding themselves either without a sustainable livelihood. What are we to do? Well, I think, as some of our speakers have already said, there are many different approaches one can take to this dilemma, and maybe it is representative, or it can be representative, of the kinds of things we can do at a global level. I want to suggest perhaps a framework for us to think about this. You know, in the 70s there was a slogan that said, think global and act local. So I want to propose that we analyze structure and enforce rights. Because a lot of this is happening at a sort of a structural level, either the global economy. I like the point that my colleague here made, that in fact September 11 is now being used as a way or the response to September 11 is being used to mask this crisis that we are engulfed in, a crisis of just basic survival. This globalization has created so much consolidation. I think, on the one hand, it has created more and more structured inequality and more poverty. And on the other hand, it's consolidated power for the powerful. Whatever the unit of power is, big economies, armies, multinationals, reckless and irresponsible consumers, high income earners, people with power are in a position to gain more power under globalization, or units with power. And at the same time, you've got a sort of an impoverishment. For example, I mean, we're consuming the idea that there is high incomes. People are consuming with extra income to the extent that they're becoming impoverished. So you have, let's say, just to pick a category, I'm not picking on Germany, but I know that the sex trade in Asia is frequented by German high-income men, and out of an economy that's doing very well, and other nationalities too. And how empowered, or how spiritually strong, or morally dynamic you can be when you have to revert to the sex trade to spend your dollar. I think there's something amiss there. On the other hand, people who have had incomes from trade that has been less controlled and contained under the WTO rubric are now losing their livelihoods. So that there is growing impoverishment. Our response, therefore, has to be to analyze all our structures. Martha said, well, are you cold or are you hot? Why are we cold, or why are we warm when we should be hot? We constantly have to analyze our experience, our structure, our reality. But then we have to think about rights. If we can hold on to the idea that we have a right to development, we have a right to a decent livelihood. These are enshrined in our national constitutions. These are enshrined in all the protocols and conventions to which our government signed. The Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the ILO, the International Labour Organization. We have these rights that are on paper, but we have to begin to move in a direction now where we could try to get them enforced. And therefore, I want to say that for the Caribbean, and the Caribbean has to be defined both in terms of the geographic region where you normally go and have your holidays, but in the context also of the Caribbean diaspora, because one in five persons born in the Caribbean is now living outside of the Caribbean. The vast majority of them right here in Brooklyn, Miami, Toronto, and so on. So that you can support the Caribbean and support its small farmers. How are you going to do that? Because part of it is to get the rules rewritten, and therefore attention to NAFTA, attention to the free trade of the Americas, free trade area of the Americas, and all of these arrangements can take up your analytic time. But then there is something we can do as consumers. We can actually buy the products that come on the market that are from the alternative sector. Now, you will not get Windward Islands bananas here in the United States, thanks to Chiquita Dole and Del Monte and other historical arrangements. You will get them in Europe, so you can call up your friends and relatives over there and tell them, go to Tesco's and go to the supermarket and buy Windward Island bananas. They are sweeter. They last longer. They are better for your body because they have less chemicals and less pesticides. And they are better for the farmers who get a higher percentage of the dollar earned. So fair trade through fair trade or organic bananas is just a basic consumer movement. I think I better stop here.
I want to thank it turned out to be a panel, actually. I thought it was going to be a round table. But we really do not have time now to have the discussion. And if you want to talk with one of the panelists, after, we'll do that. But I just want to say that in the light of where we are right now, I mean, we know from the UNICEF statistics that 17,000 children die every day of hunger in this world. Third world countries pay $128 million a day to the rich countries for the debt. And three men in the world have as much money as 43 countries. Wow. So it's wrong and it's immoral. And we are going to change it. And we're going to change it by picking up our own lives, looking at our own lives, and figuring out how do we have lifestyle integrity for the future. And thank you so much for coming.